Matthew Iglesias.
Matthew Welch.
Oh, that's right.
How
hi.
Do you do?
how do you do?
I'm doing well. I'm Matthew Iglesias.
I am Matthew Welch,
unclear.
Or Matt Welch.
We're both
I don't
Matt,
have
really.
Fancy long. Why don't you go as Matt Iglesias if that's what people call you?
I feel that the full name is a little confusing when I say it out loud to people, that sometimes that's heard as Matty Iglesias.
I get it.
So I usually say it out as Matthew, even though in real life people call me Matt.
Okay, that's fair enough.
I have my reasons.
Yeah, no, that's fine. Let's talk about Chaz Freeman. Chaz Freeman, for those of you who are unfortunate enough to get your news through newspapers, you probably haven't heard much about this interesting and, I think, kind of retarded scandal in Washington, D.C. But Chaz Freeman, a longtime diplomat, former U.S. ambassador to Saudi Arabia, former deputy, I think, chief of affairs in China, and until recently head of the Middle East Policy Council, was nominated to be the head of Obama's National Intelligence
Council.
Yes. Thank you. It provoked a very interesting and weird firestorm mostly played out in blogs and magazines of opinion, like the one that I work for, Reason, your magazine of free minds and free markets, and also
in the Senate.
And also that not incidentally in the Senate and between various people. He was seen by his critics as someone who was overly and intemperately critical of Israel, and also of having a worldview that was very sort of Saudi-centric, that was apologetic to illiberal dictator types, and of endorsing possibly the crackdown in Tiananmen Square in 1989 in various listservs that he did.
Right.
Anyways, after all this thing, he resigned yesterday. Your comment, I think, was something along the lines of Chinese democracy activists are certainly happy, which was a sardonic
It was
nod.
Indeed. Yeah, I mean, I should say, because I think this debate has been a little dominated by sort of claptrap and nonsense. You know, for my own part, that I guess I'm not that interested in Chaz Freeman. I don't have strong feelings one way or the other about the guy. When I heard he was nominated, it seemed like a weird choice to me, because my very, very, very thin knowledge of the Middle East Policy Council was based on the fact that its previous director had been George McGovern, who, while I find to be a sort of admirable person, is not usually the sort of politically sound, you know, cautious go-to place to go for foreign policy advice. Mostly interested in Chaz Freeman's enemies, who I saw to be primarily a sort of neocon group, sort of focal point being Steve Rosen, who used to be AIPAC's top lobbyist until he found himself under indictment on espionage charges, and a lot of the usual suspects, from sort of, you know, pro-Israel groups down to Chuck Schumer spearheading the opposition in the Senate, were going after Freeman, and, you know, it had become a somewhat important proxy fight over sort of how much political, you know, room for maneuver was the Obama administration going to see itself as having on Israel policy. I'm continue to be actually a little bit fuzzy on what it is the National Intelligence Council does, or why Chaz Freeman was picked for this, or who the alternatives may be. To put my cards on the table, this is more about Chaz Freeman having the right enemies than anything else to me.
But isn't there something fundamentally retarded about having an analysis to a policy question which is reduced to the enemy of my enemy is my friend, or the enemy of my enemy is more interesting because of my enemy? I mean, in this case, there's no doubt that the Israel lobby or lobbies or whatever you prefer to call it were actively engaged in trying to derail this. But it didn't take much reading around the inner tubes to note that that was not the full extent. In fact, I think just about every criticism that I read about Chaz Freeman, including ones that I wrote myself, it was not limited to Israel. It was talking about his views on Taiwan. He was talking about his comments about Tiananmen Square. And in my case, personally, I mean, I began writing about Chaz Freeman in the fall of 2001 when I started to develop an unhealthy interest in the apologetic kind of views by former U.S. ambassadors to Saudi Arabia, most of whom in recent memory have been in one way or the other beneficiaries of Saudi largesse since their retirement. And whenever there's any kind of dispute in the news having to do with the Saudi government, they could be reliably called upon to basically parrot the Saudi line in ways that are literally alarming when you go and read these long transcripts. And so why not judge this on the merits? I mean, the fact that AIPAC is excited about this is interesting, but, I mean, it's also interesting, and I don't know if it's all that worth mocking, the fact that people who were part of the democracy protests in China in 1989 wrote letters denouncing this, and that Human Rights Watch, you know, denounced this.
No, but this was telling, right? Human Rights Watch spoke against Freeman after Eli Lake, who doesn't give a shit about democracy in China, cares about Israel, cares about Iran.
How do you know that Eli Lake doesn't give a shit
about
democracy?
Because I know Eli Lake.
All right, maybe you know him better than I do, but I mean, that's an awful. I mean, if let's put Eli Lake for the purposes of this discussion in the neocon camp. I don't actually know whether he qualifies as such, but
it's
plausible.
Fair enough.
Just because of his haircut. So haven't neocons been traditionally concerned with democracy movements in China?
I don't really. I mean, this would be another discussion. I think
actually, if you are asserting that Eli Lake doesn't give a shit about democracy in China, presumably because he's a subset of a people.
Sure. Well, I think that there's some neocons definitely have an interest in sort of brewing up Cold War style confrontation between the United States and China, that they like to talk up human rights considerations in China as part of that, similar to the sort of cynical deployment of humanitarian considerations in Iraq. I don't believe that those people have a good faith concern about this. Now, Tom Malinowski, who's the guy who Eli went to get the quote, works at Human Rights Watch. You know, he's completely sincere. I think, James Fallows posted some stuff from other longtime China hands on his blog, maybe putting some of what Freeman had said about the Tiananmen Square in context. But, I think that criticism of him is fair, although I'm not really sure. I mean, again, just in terms of the politics of this, what was happening in this fight, I don't see that Freeman going down is a blow for democracy in China. I don't think that's how it's understood in the administration.
Nancy Pelosi, in a story that is sure to be ignored by the people today who are saying that the Israel lobby got another scalp and whatnot. Michael Isikoff wrote last night that Pelosi's main concern, and she was central in torpedoing this, had to do with his comments and his activities regarding China.
Well, that's interesting.
Pelosi, last time I looked, is not normally considered a member of the
Israel lobby.
It's always difficult for me to
keep That's interesting. I hadn't heard that. I'm not a huge fan of Nancy Pelosi's views on China, but she is pretty invested in China policy in her own terms. At the same time, what was I saying about this? I also do think that Saudi Arabia side, but going to China, that, a realist approach toward China is probably the correct one on the merits. I would not express the sentiments about Tiananmen Square that Chaz Freeman expressed about it, but in general, I'm very comfortable with the idea of realists being in charge of our approach to China, and actually not that comfortable with the idea of Nancy Pelosi and other people with that kind of view running it. And, I think that that's – I was a little bit surprised by actually your level of involvement in it, because I think most libertarians in the United States and Reason generally have taken a sort of realist approach to national security, especially in recent years after seeing what the kind of interventionism of the Bush administration has gotten us to.
My objection, well, first of all, I am always loath to speak for Planet Libertarian.
Sure. I don't want you to speak for it.
No.
I've just come to expect that from libertarians.
Yeah, no, that's all fair enough. I have no problem with the realist in that position, as I said last night. My problem is individually with Chaz Freeman. It's with someone who, in 2003, when asked, what's the biggest obstacle to U.S.-Saudi relations right now, in 2003, replied, oh, it's U.S. visa policies that aren't allowing enough Saudis to get through.
So you're after the Saudis.
Yeah, you know, and I just don't think that that is a very accurate assessment, is a very friendly way of putting that response. I think there's various unfriendly ways of putting that response. I think that he has demonstrated, and this, and Saudi Arabia is a country that is totally in bed with almost every single U.S. sort of intelligence dirty trick over the last 25 years. Prince Bandar walks around allegedly or reportedly with 30 suitcases filled with all the secrets that he's had involved with, like, the Iran-Contra and arms for Hostage and all kinds of skullduggery. Someone who is, you know, is, has always described himself as a friend of Saudi Arabia, who has parroted the lines and called Prince Abdullah, you know, the greatest man, who says in a single paragraph that the U.S. is the first ever genuinely autistic country, and, oh, by the way, Saudi Arabia is a wonderful place. That is someone who I think is not suited for a job involving intelligence and the filtering of intelligence and the analysis of intelligence. All of that seems to me compromised on an individual level. You can get a realist in there, that's fine. I in many ways agree that you need a realistic or realism corrective on a policy that for a while was very sort of neoconservative. From my point of view, it's the question of, I think the U.S. spends way too much time exerting itself and taking responsibility for all of the world's affairs, which neocons have zero problem with and have been part of the active project in fluffing up. But this is about team membership. I mean, why should it always be about, you know, oh, he's a member of this team, so he should be good? Why can't it be, this person individually on his merits is wrong?
Well, it totally can be that. And look, I mean, I will be thrilled if we find in Freeman's place another realist with a similar sort of broad perspective on things, a similar kind of, you know, amount of experience in the world with diplomatic and intelligence matters, but who has a more skeptical view of the Saudi government. I think that you're right to say that a lot of U.S. policy has been, you know, unduly tilted toward the Gulf monarchies in general, the Saudis in particular. And that, I mean, from the perspective of an outside observer, right, I mean, what's always especially egregious about that is in some ways just the level which Freeman exemplifies, the sort of social niceties that go about it all, that, you know, it's not that you see people saying, well, look, you know, to be realistic about it, you know, these guys are important, we should deal with them country to country, but a lot of kind of gushing praise, and we're going to hold hands with Prince so-and-so as we tool around the yard, and you know, I would love to see a change in that attitude.
We should move on to the next topic,
right.
but there's one of Freeman's comments along those lines is, like, you know, Prince Abdullah, I think it was, you know, he gave the most stirring foreign policy address I've seen in my 25 years in diplomacy or something like
that's
that.
That's a lot of
these
years.
Kind of niceties, the Bush walking hand in hand,
right,
you know, through the desert. It's just really appalling, I think, on a basic human level. And I don't think that it's surprising for anyone to kind of feel revolted by that. And so for me, that was the surprise in this whole episode, is that people who did express revulsion at that 3-4 years ago were rallying around a guy who exemplifies that. Let's talk about
the
stimulus.
All right. I wanted to talk about the omnibus.
Not the stimulus, the omnibus.
The omnibus.
All these Latin phrases.
Yes,
me dizzy.
It was signed into law today.
He signed it today.
What?
Okay.
Oh, maybe he didn't. I guess it just passed.
It was passed yesterday. He's, according to his only 3 times so far violated sunshine pledge, he's supposed to wait 5 days before signing it.
Is that what the pledge was?
Oh, yeah. It was the sunshine before something. Sunshine before moonshine pledge before the election says that every bill that arrives on his desk will be put online on the whitehouse.gov so that everyone in America can see it and read it and process it on some level, and then he'll sign it 5 days later. He violated it with the Lilly Ledbetter Act,
right,
with the stimulus, and with one other sort of a liberal.
I have to say, I would really hope that he would tear that pledge up, because that's idiotic.
Why do you say that's idiotic?
Well, because, it makes no difference. It would be, I had thought that the pledge he was violating had to do with the final text of the bill being put online somewhere for people's consumption for some period of time before the final congressional vote. You know, like at a time when the public reading it and weighing in could possibly make a difference. But here, I mean, everyone agrees that he's going to sign the bill. And so, you know, this strikes me as akin to his lobbyist pledge, you know, a kind of a sort of fraudulent pledge that was made during the campaign, you know, that has this kind of veneer of clean government to it, but that's substantively meaningless.
I think his
campaign
was
full of that kind of thing in a
disappointing way. Which you pointed out at the time.
I said about the lobbyists. Yeah, I didn't understand that this is what the Sunshine Pledge had been.
Again, I could be wrong. Let's go to the tape and have the commenters duke it out.
Could be. Anyway, I was a little surprised and continue to be now that it's been voted on at how monomaniacally focused the opponents of this bill were on the earmarks that were in it. That, you know, it's the federal government, so, you know, there's like all kinds of numbers that would be really big in your life but are really small in the federal government. And the earmarks here struck me as exactly that. I mean, you have John McCain ranting and raving about $620,000 for cricket eradication in Utah. Well, nobody was talking about, you know, the pretty substantial programmatic changes that are included in this.
I think that you're very right on a level of that. I've long been critical, at least internally in my own brain, of the Republican sort of obsession with finding the most, like, you know, disgusting most outrageous, you know, we're giving money to a hippie museum in upstate New York type of approach.
And these weren't even particularly funny, I thought. It wasn't like the mob museum of yesteryear. I mean, you know, pest control.
And for me, this seems like
the kind of thing a government would do.
I think one of the reasons why it's easy to focus, I mean, there are some people who are very principled against that, and John McCain is one of them, and I think to his credit, Jeff Flake is another one. For some reason, if you're from Arizona, you are hostile to earmarks, mm-hmm. and I think that's a healthy response. What's perhaps unhealthy is politically pretending that these are the most important things. I mean, the whole, like, Pork Busters initiative, which I was happy to see, nonetheless, sort of ignored the fact that the engines running the grotesque growth of government under George W. Bush wasn't earmark related. Earmarks are more symbolic of the fact that on some level legislators aren't serious depending on which earmark that you're talking about,
right.
That it's horse trading, that in a time when we're all pinching pennies and tightening our belts and whatever depression era metaphor you want to come up with, you don't see the same kind of discipline in Congress. And it is on some level outrageous, but what's more outrageous from the point of view of me and not you is that we're just spending money like it's going out of style. And in a way that's not necessarily interesting, though I'm eager to hear how you think the way that this money being spent is interesting or transformative, because I don't think that the stimulus bill, to the extent that I'm familiar with it, really was. It felt much more kind of shovel-ready, let's throw money out there, let's fill in budget shortfalls in states,
right.
let's keep teachers.
You know, I mean, this omnibus bill, I mean, as with any sort of, to explain it, you know, it actually funds the spending that the different government agencies were supposed to do. So most of it is just the same as what the previous year's appropriation had been. But there's
plus 8.5%.
Yeah, well, but I mean, but it's not just an across the board 8.5%. I mean, is the point. There's some pretty big increases in Pell Grant money, in sort of food stamps and WIC money, in mass transit funding, Head Start funding. You know, I mean, it's sort of the things you would expect Democrats to kind of go to town on if they were able to take over. But, you know, that's what they've done, and it's not a, you know, it's not like the second coming of the New Deal or something like that. But the Bush administration obviously did not, you know, cut government spending to the bone, but there was a significant change in what money was spent
on. That's a bit of an understatement.
Right, and most domestic anti-poverty programs and programs targeted at cities saw reductions relative to baseline, in some cases in real terms, in the money they had. And there were then big increases in spending on defense, on homeland security, and the entitlements, you know, continued to drift upwards throughout this. The Democrats did not pare back the entitlement money, but did put back in a lot of the anti-poverty stuff, a lot of the urban-focused stuff. And, you know, I mean, I understand that Republicans have principled and not so principled objections to that kind of thing. They had been in power for a long time. Those weren't the priorities they had. And yet they kind of let this shift in priorities, you know, go by almost unmentioned in favor of this, you know, stuff about crickets. You know, and I would say that I think it's not 100% a coincidence that Arizona is a hotbed of anti-earmark agitation. They get there's an enormous amount of federal spending in Arizona, just sort of in the regular budget, because it's a big defense contracting hotbed, things like that. So, you know, they kind of get a lot of money from Uncle Sam, completely apart from the earmarks. So it's convenient. Although I do think it's correct to object to the earmarks. That it's a bit of a it's a good way for John McCain to sort of both be bringing home the bacon to his constituents and also to have this kind of thing that he can take a strong stand against. Other members feel, you know, that if they don't bring this stuff home, they'll get in trouble, which is why you had a lot of senators, you know, denouncing the earmarks on the floor while then putting their own in the bill.
Ron Paul, as a congressman, is
he did
that.
Kind of Lindsey Graham, I think.
There's an intellectual defense for that, one that I don't necessarily buy, but that you could be principled against earmarks in general, think that they're unconstitutional, which is likely that's what Ron Paul thinks, because he thinks most everything is unconstitutional.
But that you may, yeah.
But that you have to deliver, you know, the bacon to your constituents.
I mean, I think that's fair. I mean, I think we should change the campaign finance rules, but I have no objection to politicians raising money the way the current system allows them to. Right, I mean, you can't run unless you solicit private donations from people. So
right.
That's what they do.
Right. Which is, so you want fully funded government campaigns?
No, I don't think I want that. I think I want this Patriot dollar idea, where basically, like, everyone would have a set amount of money that they're supposed to contribute to someone.
That sounds terrible.
No, it'd be great.
Why not have a mandatory vote while you're at it? So it could be like Australia and Cuba.
Australia and Cuba, yes. Two peas in a pod.
No, I mean, I would prefer to be neither. You know, no, I mean, the idea that compulsory, you have to get involved in the political system, I think that's contrary to the whole, you know, life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness.
Well, the idea would be that there would be a... It's a big government scheme. The idea is that everyone would get, like, $50 that they could assign to whomever they wanted, or they could leave unassigned, but not keep for themselves. The point is that bureaucrats know better than you what you should be doing with your money.
Right.
To be clear.
There was, in the Omnibus Bill 2, at least from what I quickly glanced at this morning's headlines, that in addition to all of the programs that you talked about, they also basically kneecapped the D.C. school vouchers program.
Well, that's what I had read at first, but it's what they did was they said that they would fund it for one more year, I guess the year we're in, and that then it would die unless it was reauthorized next year, which I don't know if that actually could. I hope that that does not kill the program. Because the program should not be
killed. Why in hell would that be a priority for anybody right now? I mean, I read Dick Durbin's comment was like, we have to carefully judge the way this money is being spent,
right.
Which I really wonder if he was applying that principle to any other part of this entire bill.
Well, I mean, of course, you know, this is, you know, Republicans don't want to spend money on anything other than, you know, this voucher program, and Democrats don't like it because, you know, because teachers don't like it.
Or a teachers' union don't like it. I think that there's a
yes.
Usually a substantive difference between those two things.
Although I think that in this instance the unions speak for their members and their members are wrong.
Do you have any evidence to back that up?
I mean, it's pure. The teachers I know, including at least one, who is furious at the DC Teachers Union for its stance on Michelle Rhee's, you know, performance pay thingamabob, is still really, really, really adamantly against vouchers.
I spent the weekend by...
I assume that the teachers in the private schools that receive the vouchers are more friendly to the vouchers. At least I would hope.
I think that's a fair assumption. I mean, for me, I mean, you talk about symbolism, and one point I want to make about the earmark symbolism is that Obama, to great fanfare, said that you know, he's going to do everything he can to have an earmark-free administration. So I think we've seen that that's not going to happen, but that wasn't a very difficult thing to predict. But to me, the symbolism of this is kind of appalling. That, I mean, in a time when Obama is saying we need to transform education, that, you know, in particular, I'm quitting on America because I'm not going to ever get a college degree. There's nothing transformative about blocking vouchers. I mean, if there's anything that seems to help out public school systems, it seems to me allowing people to go to school where they want to and maybe easing up and allowing for the growth and proliferation of charter schools, these things work. I mean, school choice works. And to have...
Right. I completely agree. I mean, look, I think if you look at the DC voucher program, the evidence suggests that the kids, in fact, don't do any better when they go to the private schools. But nonetheless, the symbolism is so terrible that you should keep the program going. And also, what the evidence does show is that the kids and their parents are much happier with their new schools. They're to some extent, I think, confused, but the mere fact that they are happier with the schools they pick is a perfectly legitimate reason to let them go to it. And Obama said in his speech, I thought one of the best parts of the speech was a very sort of stern thing about charter schools and the fact that states need to lift the cap on the number of charter schools that they allow. And this is, I mean, when you talk about school choice in D.C., the charter school issue is really where the action is happening. A lot of the private schools are actually converting themselves into charter schools, which I think is good. The number of charters has been expanding, which I think is good. But it's definitely not consistent at all with the spirit of that to be killing the DC voucher program. In a macro sense, you know, it's very few people involved, but it I think raises a lot of questions as to whether Obama is going to be able to get congressional Democrats to agree to the stuff he was talking about in his speech yesterday.
I mean, I think that we have seen that there can be, at any given point, a pretty significant gap between Obama's rhetoric and governing policy. And sure, that's a kind of shocked type of thing. But it is kind of consistently interesting, you know.
Well, but also there can be a gap between, you know, a president's policy and what his congressional allies' policy is.
But for example, I recall in the blogging wars of yesteryear that you and Mickey Kouse frequently clash over teachers' unions. You were sort of minimizing his objections to them. Isn't this a early indication that his negative and cynical take might be worth at least considering?
Well, but it's a question of I think the teachers' unions are wrong on this issue, and I mean, I think it's definitely worth considering whether or not Congress, in a larger sense, is going to go forward with the agenda that Obama has outlined, or whether they're going to go forward with the agenda that the NEA has outlined. I mean, that's perfectly legitimate.
Is there significant, like, real legislative difference between Obama's ideas and the NEA ideas? Can you break down for us, since you've looked at this closer than I have, what are the points of difference?
Oh, yeah. I mean, probably the clearest one is this issue of the charter schools. I mean, he said in his speech that states should lift their caps on charter schools. That's something that teachers' unions have sometimes said they agree with, but in practice have almost never got along with, and that in some states, like in Massachusetts in particular, where I voted for Mitt Romney in 2002 in part over education issues. But since Deval Patrick has come in, there's been some rolling back of some of the things that have made the Massachusetts school system good, and trying to squeeze the number of charter schools has been prominent in that. And you see that in many states. The other thing is that Obama talked about gathering data on student performance and linking that data to evaluations of teachers, which is something that the unions have been very much against. I think New York State had the most infamous one of these, where they have actually like a pretty good system for tracking the data, but they put a rule in place that said, well, you're not allowed to consider the data on how well the teachers do when you're deciding whether or not to fire them, which is not – that's a stupid idea. And
it's pervasive. I mean, in public school systems, even if you come up with a merit pay kind of schemes, those merit pay mechanisms are generally set or controlled in some ways by unions, and they become toothless. It's really...
Yeah, I mean, there's this dispute underway about, you know, could you do maybe merit on the school level or on the individual level? But, I mean, this is a big point of conflict. And it's a point of conflict between the administration and the union. Of course, there's different unions in different places. So one of the things that recommended Arne Duncan to the administration was that Duncan had gotten the teachers union in Chicago to agree to a lot of the kind of things that teachers unions in other cities have resisted. So to some people,
like
that means maybe Duncan is a miracle worker, but I think it could just be that the Chicago Teachers Union is more, you know, open to reform than the Teachers Union in some other places.
It's all, as someone who has an 8-month-old daughter and, you know, who I spent my entire life in public schools, it's all very depressing. You know, I would have hoped that a sort of a moment of change would include an acknowledgement that we've doubled spending per pupil in the last 40 years and haven't really seen any improvements, and that there are pretty widely acknowledged, you know, obstacles to progress in public education, and a new sort of regime in Washington is squabbling, or is, you know, even if there are some good ideas, there's early indications that we're not going to see improvements in public education. I think that's just a shame.
I'll say this. It will be a shame if that's what happens, but I think, you know, we should see. I mean, the president's speech was yesterday. I think it was very strong on reforms. I hope those ideas will be enacted. I hope Republicans will support those ideas. So, because one thing that happens is that, right, when every single Republican says, well, we're just going to vote no on everything, then Obama, to pass anything, needs the votes of every single Democrat, which means that whatever random corrupt interest any Democratic senator is listening to, you know, carries the day. I don't think that Obama's education agenda is, you know, the conservative agenda, but I think it has enough things that enough Democrats don't like that to pass it, he's going to need some Republicans to support it.
And not just Arlen Specter. Speaking of which, let's move to card check.
Yes.
You wrote something yesterday that I thought was silly. Let me see if I can find it on my computer.
I was talking about the Chamber of Commerce and how they hate unions.
This kind of absolutism here. Let's see. Your typical business executive would rather let the world burn or see his children fed to a pack of wild boars than see a union form at his firm, because businessmen appreciate the value of class solidarity. You realize that's nonsense, right?
I really don't.
You're just having
fun. Did you read the article I linked to? I mean, this is far and away.
I'm a blog consumer.
Yeah.
I only click on the links when it's glaring. This is
what they are on about, and I promise you that the Chamber of Commerce's concern with this is not about, you know, the details of the election procedure, which is why they're not only opposed to the majority sign-up provision, they're opposed to every single element of the Employee Free Choice Act, because, for example, they don't want stiff penalties for illegal employer violations of labor law, because they love illegally violating labor law to make it hard to form unions. They hate unions.
I don't doubt that for a second that the chamber is a generally anti-union, but to say that each individual businessman hates unions flies in the face of what happens everywhere. I mean, to cite just one of a trillion examples, by which I mean probably three, you know, back at in L.A., the largest single developer of downtown real estate in L.A., it's basically the biggest developer in L.A., only hires unions. And he agitates and advocates largely in City Hall for living wage ordinances.
Yes, yes,
this
no,
is
no,
a
no,
guy
no, no, no.
who does business with Bill of Anschutz.
You're completely right. That's hyperbole. There are businessmen who have alliances with you.
Businessmen respond to it. There was a Peter Overby did a piece on NPR the other day, which spoke almost wonderingly, like, you know, even though businessmen are almost always Republicans, some are finding ways to do business with the Obama administration. Mm-hmm. This strikes me as having a real shocking naivete about how business and regulation and government interact. I mean, businessmen try to game the regulatory system to their advantage, and understandably so. And if you're going to do that, you're going to do business with Democrats, and you're going to realize the advantages of, for instance, in a place like L.A., where there is a dominant political culture that's very in bed with unions, public and private sector, that it's going to redound to your benefit if you mouth those lines too. And so, I mean, it's sort of silly, I think, just to portray businessmen as these sort of monolithic people who are Republican by, you know, nature and nurture.
I never said businessmen were Republicans. I mean, the whole point of that was that the majority of businessmen and those who control the attitude of the Chamber of Commerce, who are virulently anti-union, have plenty of Democrats in their pocket, which is why Democrats who were happy to support Employee Free Choice Act when it had no chance of passing are now, you know, turning against it. Because, you know,
right.
Mark Pryor, or what's the other one? The other one from Arkansas, you know, they're... I think when they are in the minority, business doesn't particularly care what Mark Pryor thinks about things. But when Democrats are in the majority, business, you know, needs to play with politicians, and there's plenty of Democrats who are, you know, thrilled to play ball with them.
Now, why should we think it's a good idea to change federal unionization rules so that a secret ballot, which is traditionally the way that people can vote with the most sense of freedom, I guess, is replaced by a more sort of public putting your name on cards. Why is that a good idea for this country?
Why is that a good... Wait, okay. There are plenty of circumstances in which you do things through mechanisms other than the secret ballot. And one circumstance in which it can be done is for a union. The rule here is about if a majority of people in a given workplace sign up to say they want a union, that then the employer has to recognize the union. The alternative to this is the election mechanism, where it's been documented that employers take advantage of the election campaign to do a lot of, you know, intimidation, a lot of, you know, getting down with employees, saying, well, you know, we're going to fire you if you speak in favor of the union, et cetera, et cetera.
Right. All that intimidation is illegal. Right? I mean, under current law, you cannot intimidate a union or a union member in advance of election.
Right. Right? It's illegal, but it's extremely widespread. The Center for Economic Policy Research had a study on this, and, you know, they showed that in something like over half of these cases, NLRB finds violations of the law, and that's even with an NLRB, which is being staffed by Republicans who are not interested in this sort of thing. However, I will hasten to agree that if we're talking about a discussion where there is sort of good faith agreement that, you know, employer violations of labor law and difficulties getting a sort of fair vote, if there can be agreement on that, I am not personally wedded to the majority sign-up procedure as the be-all and end-all of this. It's not the only provision of the bill. It's not, in my opinion, the most important provision of the bill. That's why it was noteworthy. I thought that the chamber spokesman was talking about how there can be no compromise on this, because I think a lot of people have been talking about, well, maybe instead of majority sign-up, we could just have a faster election process.
Right.
I think that doing the elections quickly solves the legitimate concerns on both sides of this.
There's the other thing that I've seen people object to from my side of the aisle has been the having federal arbitrators come in and when there's a dispute over a labor contract, come in and basically set the terms.
Right.
Which from their arguments, and I don't know enough about it, is a pretty strong change from status quo and one that on its face doesn't sound necessarily promising to me, though I haven't studied the issue very closely. I mean, part of I recall reading up on this a couple years back, and the creation of the secret ballot to begin with was a union idea, and there's something kind of strange to me about, like, we all change our opinion on whether this is a good idea or a bad idea based on what labor is excited about this week. This sort of strikes me as weird. And then there's a more kind of supplementary or complementary question about all of this, and it came up in Obama's speech when he signaled his support of this, is that, you know, labor unions equal middle class. They created mm-hmm. middle class. They're the key to middle class. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Is that true? I mean, are you a member of the middle class, and have you ever been a member of a union or worked at a unionized place?
I have not ever been a member of a union. I'm not sure whether it's true that unions create the middle class. Well, the existence of unions drives up wages for people working in comparable industries, whether or not they're in them. But
As long as those industries stay in business, which they tend to do probably a little bit less when they're unionized, right?
I wouldn't really say that that's the case. I mean, I think it's more that, I mean, as you alluded to, right, I mean, we've changed labor law a number of times in this country. The most heavily unionized private sector industries are the ones that grew very rapidly during the 15, 20-year window when labor law was very favorable to unions. That was now 60, 70 years ago, so it's natural that sort of those industries are on the wane. I think that if you look around the world, you know, at which countries maintain a decent level of economic equality and also a good level, you know, overall level of prosperity, of economic growth, of so on and so forth, that you generally see relatively high levels of union density, and it serves as a countervailing institution in political affairs, and it also serves as a labor market institution that compresses wage ratios. I think the claim that the unions created the middle class historically has some validity to it. It's obviously not true that any individual person needs to be in a union to have a middle class living standard.
Yeah, I mean, something about it, and maybe this is just a result of my upbringing in what traditionally was the most hysterically anti-union town, and which has switched to become a totally pro-union town, or area of Southern California. But it always seems to me that there's like a nostalgia for a time that no one has lived through on some level. When you talk about unionization and argue about it with people, you get the triangle shirtwaist fire within the first 5 minutes. Uh-huh. And I'm like, yeah, that was really interesting. And, you know, 100 and some odd years ago. I mean, I was in that civics class, too, and I went through the mock trial as well. But let's sort of talk about how the world works right now. It's interesting to me that a lot of the people who were, you know, very excited and championing this and talking about, I mean, has Harold Meyerson ever belonged to a union?
I'm sure he has.
He probably has. I'll give him that credit. But it's just a lot of people who talk about this constantly just sort of wouldn't even fathom a union in their workplace. And in the field that I work in and that you work in to some degree, although who knows how a think tank is run, I just don't see this making sense too much.
I mean, I have to say,
I'm in favor of the freedom to
really kind of disagree with that. You know, when I have had previous jobs in which I kind of wished that there was a union that we were in, and that
that's just because you got fired and you felt bad about it.
What did I get fired from?
I'm just kidding.
Okay.
I'm spreading lies about you on the internet.
Jeez.
We're going to talk about your career here.
All right. We can do that. What's up with my career?
Yeah.
It's all thanks to you, you realize.
You want to explain the readers how Matt Welch was
the first person to ever link to my blog.
That's back when you were like pro legalization of marijuana, and
I'm still more or less pro legalization.
More or less. Didn't you have a blog post a week or a month or two ago expressing newly expressed doubt about
something? Well, I said I thought they should let people smoke marijuana, but maybe not let stores like market that they were selling marijuana, or have there be like marijuana companies, you know, traded on the stock market.
What's wrong with having like cannabis clubs and stuff like that?
I'm not sure exactly where cannabis clubs fall on that market.
I mean, they're a business. They make money.
Fall on that spectrum. You know, I think the concern that was being expressed by Mark Kleiman, which I thought was a reasonable one, was that a sort of a pot marketing apparatus would have bad public health consequences. But what he said and what I agreed with was that at the end of the day, full legalization with some kind of tax would be preferable to the status quo. So if that's what people want to do, I welcome them to.
I am heartened. I mean, probably the single biggest thing that I've liked about Obama's administration right now so far has been his announcement that the DEA will no longer raid medical marijuana facilities. I think and I hope that in conjunction with the Michael Phelps case, which was sort of an interesting kind of metapolitical thing, where it just felt to me, and granted I'm in a pot haze bubble, even though I don't smoke this stuff, that the reaction, even in the nation's sports pages, which are not known for their progressive thought, was a grand collective shrug.
Well, there's definitely no good reason for meaningful federal policy in this area. I mean, we have to this day some dry counties, and I don't think, I mean, I don't support prohibition of alcohol, but I also don't find it, outrageous that some counties, mostly in the South, one in Maine, ban selling alcohol there. I think that, in terms of marijuana policy, it would make a lot more sense to let different communities, adjust to what they think their values are and their priorities.
It's an interesting thing where, especially during the Bush administration, that and a few other cases, especially involving environmental policies, started to develop a liberal case for federalism. I think there was even a New York Times cover story by somebody in our universe who wrote, liberals are learning to love federalism when they don't control the federal apparatus.
Yeah.
My worry is
that was a long 2 years.
That was a long 2 years, yeah. My worry, I'm not a consistent or manic federalist. I don't think that the federal government should get involved in every last thing, and I think that the trend line is ominous as far as that is concerned, sort of centralization of power in Washington, and the notion that Washington is responsible for anything that happens, whether it's, the value of your house falling or whether it's cricket research in Utah or whatever the hell. I do think, agree with you that it makes some sort of basic sense, especially on kind of hot button issues, to have that work out on the states. It's always very difficult then when you get into, but then do you let your local state discriminate against African Americans and this kind of stuff? And of course, you don't. So I think that everyone is a federalism hypocrite, but that.
I don't even think there's a real need to be consistent about it. I mean, honestly, there's just some things which are not. They don't implicate super deep ethical values, right? I mean, if North Dakota wants to discriminate against marijuana dealers, I don't think that's the worst thing in the world. If North Dakotans have a powerful sense about that, but at the same time, if Californians are comfortable with a different kind of legal regime, there's no reason that the federal government should be stopping them. It's not a genuinely national concern. And it doesn't require any of this special financial powers of the federal government. I mean, policing is being done locally as it is.
Yeah, although it's being North Dakota is an interesting example. If I'm not mistaken, that is the lead example of a great piece that Jacob Solem wrote for us in the last fall, talking about federal raids of paraphernalia shops, which end up being sort of prosecuted on speech things. I mean, what they object to is the fact that the High Times magazine is in the window making a mockery of it all. And if I'm not mistaken, the story was about how basically there were DEA raids on either in North Dakota or Idaho paraphernalia place that had gone to the trouble of making sure with the local sheriff and all
the local authorities.
Like, hey, I'm doing everything right here, right?
Right, and that's exactly the kind of thing that needs to be done away with, reeled in. I mean, let the local sheriff worry about what's in the sign.
Yeah.
Right.
But I just worry that, you know, in the same way that, let's say, a Bill Clinton, the last thing in the world that he would have ever really thought about was appearing to look halfway soft on crime.
Right.
And so let's execute the retards and stuff.
Right.
I am afraid that Obama will lack the nerve. And, in fact, he's never campaigned on it, so I don't see him doing anything much beyond what he's already said and done. And I think that would be a shame. It would sort of take – I think we do have a historic opportunity here to just change something that everyone, you know, with the possible exception of Mark Klein, but even he's come around to it, everyone recognizes is just ridiculous.
Well, but you know,
treating marijuana like a dangerous
drug.
Yeah,
but you know, I saw a poll on this, and it showed it was about 42% of the public.
Which was the highest, but it's still not.
Right. I mean, it's
high.
Not.
I don't know what the.
It's weird. I mean, if you travel in whatever circles you and I both travel in, it seems like the spectrum of opinion runs from, you know, they should be selling heroin at 7-Eleven to drugs should be decriminalized. But in the real world, there's actually a lot of support for, you know, for strong anti-drug measures with criminal law, and I think those people are. A little bit nuts, but that's why I do think that decentralization is the best hope. I mean, I think you let the people who want really stringent policies, you know, out of some concern about their children or whatever, you know, have them, you know, where they live, and
Let's talk about how you assess the great President Barack Hussein Obama III.
Yes.
So far, are you happy with what he's done? Sad, middling.
I think if I like listed all the things he's done, I'm happy with, you know, with most of them. But it's all sort of overwhelmed by this, you know, dark cloud of banks and bailouts and that controversy, and I don't really see that he's done, you know, much of anything on that. And if he doesn't, I'm not entirely sure that I know what the right answer is, but unless he comes up with the right answer, you know, unless they come up with the right answer, the presidency is going to be a failure. And, you know, the fact that I may or may not, you know, like the Lilly Ledbetter Act is sort of all going to be washed away.
Yeah, I mean, if I can sort of take myself out of the ideology of it and look at the practicality of it, I mean, the fact that there's been some pretty big pieces of legislation and also pretty big kind of things that are coming up, energy policy, you know, he's going to create those, you know, 3.5 million green jobs that we've all been just waiting for, you know, even education, I don't think it's a hugely different program, but he's announced it as like a big, we need to change this.
Yeah.
Health care, we need to change this. So, and also the stimulus. Now, at some point, it's a lot of money that we're talking about, and we're running up debts that, of the likes we haven't seen since World War II, and you just have kind of a limit of what is possible at a time when you also still haven't, as you point out, really come up with a plan for the banks, or at least one that is comprehensible to people. And as that is the kind of burning, you know, hot ember behind this whole thing, that I wonder and worry, kind of looking on the outside of it, you know, whether there's going to be much left over to deal with that issue, because that is huge. There's many parts of it that are kind of unknown, perhaps unknowable, and you know, the one aspect of his leadership that troubles me, and this was brought up in a blogging heads that I did with Andres Martinez, is that wasn't the first order of business or the second order of business. Maybe it was, but it didn't translate into policy or sort of a battle plan that I've seen.
Right. I mean, I don't think it's the problem. I mean, it's a complicated problem, so you have to, you know, you have to work on it. Some of this other stuff, they had off-the-shelf plans, you know, that people had been working on for years before he actually came into office. So I think it's understandable that the sequence is going this way. But it's not going to matter, right? I mean, the presumption behind all of his budgeting is that there will be a return to economic growth. Right. I mean, if you don't have that, then...
And it's like 3.1%.
Right. I mean, all of the kind of talk about just the nominal dollar figures in the budget is meaningless if you don't have the assumption that the economy is going to return to growing. Which I think, you know, is an assumption most people make, but it is contingent on doing something about the financial system. Their policies on this have been rolling out slowly, and, you know, I don't see any kind of strong consensus, even a strong consensus of slightly left of center economists or of anyone that what they're doing is going to work. And if they can't do that, it's not going to matter that they have good ideas on healthcare or anything else. It's not going to be doable. It's not going to be workable, and it's not going to be sustainable unless there's growth, which means I don't know exactly what it means for the banking system, but it means something. You can't just have what we're doing right now forever.
Yeah, and keep going back to the well to give another tranche to AIG. You wrote a book, Heads in the Sand, about foreign policy in the Democratic Party.
I did.
What is your assessment, filter, whatever, on Obama and his foreign policy and how it fits with your overall thesis?
I think that Obama, as far I liked Obama in the primaries mostly because of his foreign policy. Then I had a real whiplash when he was going to make Hillary Clinton Secretary of State, because that was the reason I wasn't voting for her in the first place. But then I think, as we saw the rest of the appointments come out, and we've seen his approach so far, that it's very good. It's a sort of realist approach, tempered by an internationalist approach, of course also tempered by the fact that there's like a new Great Depression coming on and just like a lack of appetite for foreign adventurism. So I don't really know if, like, deep down, he and Bob Gates, like, want to launch a bunch of new wars. But
he does want to double down in Afghanistan, right? And he's already started that process.
Well, it's not doubling what he's doing. I think, now, this remains to be seen. My understanding so far is that what he's going to do in Afghanistan is things I approve of. It's going to be trying to reel back the objectives somewhat to make them more realistic. He's going to try to, you know, cut some deals with some people. I think that's all good. Now, when their strategic review is done, he may actually come up with a different plan, in which case, you know, to hell with him.
When is the strategic review due?
End of the month. Yeah. It's
eagerly
awaited.
We're running out of time here, and I wanted to hit on the your career. Think Progress now. They just have you as a blogger, or are you like actively stroking your chin and awaiting your appointment as Undersecretary to Samantha Power?
No, I just blog, you know, and I go to meetings when people want me there.
Right. And you came from there, and you've been there for how long now? Have you held a job for more than 6 months?
I've had this job for a little bit more than 6 months. Before that, I was at The Atlantic for like a year.
That's
13, 14 months.
And finally, are you coming over to the Reason HQ on Friday? We're having a big John Stossel viewing party.
I don't know. I don't really like John Stossel.
Then you can throw you can throw pomegranates.
I don't really want to do that either. He's got an annoying voice.
No, you
speak no ill of John Stossel. I know.
He's a great genius. I think that he's got a fantastic mustache, and in the times that I've met him, I find him to be an endearing man.
Fair enough.
But we're having a other program involved, too, that you might find interesting.
All right.
But we can talk about that offline.
Fair enough.
This was fun, and fare thee well, and I look forward to seeing what you have to say about the strategic review.
Exactly. All right. Thank you. Good times. Take care.
Good time. Bye-bye.